Sin never dies a natural death. May I say that again? Sin never dies a natural death. It must always be judged. Either we must judge it or God will judge it. Sin never dies a natural death. It must always be judged. Either we ourselves judge the sin or God judges it. Tonight in the prophecy of Hosea, we will notice in chapters 8, 9, and 10 that God is judging because Israel failed to judge their own sin. This is a principle that we find in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. If we would judge ourselves, we would not be being judged by God. But if we do not judge ourselves, then it is necessary for us, of course, to be judged by God. But before we look at these three chapters, Hosea chapters 8, 9, and 10, let's just take a word or two, a moment or two for review. After all, repetition is the mother of learning. As you well know, the prophecy of Hosea is dealing with the northern kingdom. And it is looking at the northern kingdom just in the days and the years preceding its fall. Israel is the northern kingdom known as Ephraim. Hosea saw this northern kingdom go from relative prosperity to absolute anarchy until finally the Assyrians in 722 B.C. just swept down into Israel and carried the people away captive. They could actually walk into that nation and carry it away because of the corruption and the moral weakness of that people. The prophecy itself is in two sections. There is, first of all, the personal experience of Hosea himself. We call this the prodigal wife in the first three sections, where he marries a woman who is very immoral and begets children who are not children born of that marriage. And the three children portray the fortunes and the future of Israel: Jezreel, Lo-Ruhamah, and Lo-Ami. Jezreel, God scattered. Lo-Ruhamah, not having mercy, not having been pitied. Lo Ami, not my people. And these three children portrayed the fortunes and the future of Israel. Using this as a basis, Hosea leaps into a prophetic exhortation, which I have called the Prodigal Nation, in chapters 4 through 14. Now tonight, we will find ourselves in the prophetic exhortation, the Prodigal Nation. We have seen in two previous studies the arraignment of Israel, the accusations against Israel in chapters 4 through 7. Now tonight we come to the judgment of Israel. You notice there is first the accusation, then the judgment, and then the restoration. Right now we are in the judgment section. And here we come to the section which we'll be considering tonight. First of all, the judgment of Israel with the reasons for the judgment in chapter 8, verses 1 through 14. The judgment and the reasons for the judgment. And we will notice that there are five reasons for judgment in this particular section. Let's look at the five reasons why God is bringing judgment on Israel. Reason number one, verse 1, the transgression of the covenant, or the breaking of the covenant. Verse 1, set the trumpet to thy mouth. He shall come like an eagle against the house of the Lord. That is, the Assyrian will come. He shall come like an eagle against the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law. Now notice, the covenant was broken and the law was broken. Two things, the covenant and the law. Now, with this in mind, turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 28. Deuteronomy chapter 28. In Deuteronomy chapter 28 and following, we have what is known as the Palestinian covenant that God made with Israel. And you'll notice there is blessing and cursing here. Deuteronomy chapter 28. May I read the first few verses of chapter 28? That's Deuteronomy chapter 28. And it shall come to pass, if thou shalt hearken diligently unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe and to do all his commandments, which I command thee this day, that the Lord thy God will set thee on high above all nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come on thee, and overtake thee, If thou shalt hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, blessed shalt thou be in the city, and blessed shalt thou be in the field. Blessed shall be the fruit of thy body, and the fruit of thy ground, and the fruit of thy cattle, the increase of thy cows, and of the flocks of thy sheep. Blessed shall be thy basket and thy netting cross. Blessed, and so on. Now verse 15. But it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. Cursed shalt thou be in the city, and cursed shalt thou be in the field. Cursed shall be thy basket and thy kneading trough. Cursed shall be the fruit of thy body and the fruit of thy land, the increase of thy cows and the flocks of thy sheep, and so on. Blessing and cursing. Now, chapter 29. Look at it carefully. These are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, beside the covenant which he made with them in Horeb. Now, first of all, where is Moab? Anybody know where Moab is? Huh? Moab is on this side of the Dead Sea, right over here. This is the land of Moab. And the children of Israel are just ready to go into the land of Palestine. And so God is making this covenant called the Palestinian Covenant with Israel through the hands of Moses before they get into the land. If they obey it, well, they'll have blessings. If they don't, cursing shall come upon them, and they will be removed. Now, chapter 29, verse 1 says that you make this covenant with Israel in the land of Moab, beside the covenant which he made them in Horeb. Where is Horeb? Right, thank you. Sinai and Horeb are the same. Mount Sinai is Mount Horeb. And what was given at Mount Sinai? Well, the law of Moses. So you have the covenant of Deuteronomy 28 and the law given in Exodus chapter 20 on Mount Horeb. And this is what Hosea is talking about in Hosea chapter 8. They transgressed the law and they broke the covenant. And therefore, God has no recourse but to remove them from the land, because this was the agreement. This was the covenant that God had made with his chosen people in Moab and in Horeb. Now let's go back to Hosea chapter 8. Hosea chapter 8. We're looking at now the reasons for God's judgment on Israel. Given one, the transgression of the covenant. The second reason is given in verses 2 through 4, and I have called it schismatic kings, or if you'd like to make another title, you may want to say false kings. They had set up false kings. Look at verse 4. They have set up kings, but not by me. They have made princes, and I knew it not. Now, you may remember that when Israel was in the land of the north here, they did not want the people to go south to this kingdom of Judah. They had divided into two kingdoms. Right here is Jerusalem. They did not want the people to come down to Jerusalem to worship in Jerusalem, so they set up their own false priests. Furthermore, they set up their own king. The king that was ruling down here was a descendant of David. All the promises of Israel were with the line of David. There was not one king in the north who was of the line of David. All of these were false kings. They were usurpers. So when he says, you've set up kings, but not in my will, not the way I wanted to do it, you set up your own kings. Therefore, of course, they were going to be punished. So the second reason for the judgment is the false king. Chapter 8, verses 2 through 4. The third reason. Idolatry, verses 5 through 7. Now let's look at this a little bit more carefully. Verse 5. Thy calf, O Samaria, has cast thee off. Now why does he say thy calf? Because they were worshiping idols in the form of a calf. So he's saying, thy calf, O Samaria, northern kingdom, has cast me off. Mine anger is kindled against them. How long will it be before they attain to innocence? For from Israel was it also, the workman made it, therefore it is not God. But the calf of Samaria shall be broken in pieces. He's looking at the idolatry. Now look at verse 7. For they have sown the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. Have you ever heard that expression? Why, obviously you have. What's the wind? And what is the whirlwind? They have sown the wind, that is, they have gone into idolatry. They have false worship. Because they have been involved in false worship, they will reap the whirlwind of judgment. They will reap the whirlwind of God's corruption. That's what he is saying. They've sown to the wind, and they will reap the whirlwind. How many of you have seen this experience? How many of you have seen this experience in the lives of other people? May I turn it around? How many of you have seen this own experience in your own life? You've gone into sin, you've done something wrong, and you have seen the whirlwind sweep back into your life. Far worse than you'd ever expected it. There's more in this passage. I want you to notice that as you look at these verses, these people are still involved in worship, even though it's not the true worship. Now, that impressed me as I read this. People will leave the true worship, and instead of abandoning worship, which would be the logical conclusion, they go to some other worship. Now, it seemed to me, as I look at myself logically, if I would become an apostate, if I would throw off Christianity, if I would throw off Jesus Christ, I wouldn't be anything. I mean, I'd quit. But that's not the way people work. When they throw off Christianity, they go into some other cult or some other religion or something else. It struck me that the most recent Life magazine has a long section called The Quest for Spiritual Revival. And here's a picture. I thought it was a girl, but it's a man. Here's a picture of a man sitting on a hillside overlooking a plain, and he's involved in a yogi breathing exercise. Tom Law is the gentleman's name, but there's yogi. Then on the back is another religion being led by a Japanese fella, and it's coming into the United States very strongly. It's actually from Japan, the Soka Gakkai movement in Japan. The Soka Gakkai movement in Japan is a very militant, very, very militant Buddhist group trying to get Christians out and so on. And now they've come into the United States, and their followers number in the thousands, 40,000, I believe. Now they have 200,000 members. 40,000 came in last year. Soka Gakkai, American. Then here's another one. Here's a group of brothers, monks that left the Franciscan order to set up their own because they're dissatisfied with the Franciscan group. Here's another one. Witchcraft, pure and simple. She says she's a witch, and she's not making any bones about it. That's her work. She goes in witchcraft. Here's another man who's, for all practical purposes, a pantheist. And here's another one who is in yoga, and here's another one that's in the church. Now, this is sweet. This is nice. It's in the church. When I read this one, I thought, well, that's nothing. There's nothing here either. This is just plain, well, it's just religion. It's not the Church of Jesus Christ as we believe at all. You come into contact with God and you'll know it, or something like this. There's nothing about Jesus Christ, nothing about the rebirth, nothing about the Bible. It's just, quote, in the church, unquote. And it struck me that people can leave Jesus Christ and people can abandon genuine religion and still be hooked on religion. The Samaritans, or the Northern Kingdom, Israel, Ephraim, whatever you want to call them, had left the true religion at Jerusalem, but still they were involved in false worship. Doesn't this show that basically we have a religious nature which must be satisfied, and that can only be satisfied in Jesus Christ? So the third reason for the judgment is idolatry. There's a fourth reason. Pagan alliances. Alliances with countries which were pagan. Verses 8 through 10. For they are gone up to Assyria, a wild ass alone by himself. Ephraim hath hired lovers. Now what he means is they've gone up to Assyria for help. And he uses this strange expression, a wild ass alone by himself. Now that's being alone. A wild ass alone by himself. Now what does that mean? As I looked at the commentaries, they couldn't give me too much explanation of what this means either. But I think it means, first of all, alone, by himself, helplessness. No other help. A wild ass would look at stubborn stupidity. So it looks at Israel as being all by itself, but stubbornly, persistently, and stupidly going to another nation for help, just like a wild ass alone by itself in the wilderness, going to any place it can for help. And instead of going to the Lord, they were going to a pagan nation like Assyria, which ultimately, by the way, destroyed them. So we see them as a wild ass alone by themselves, but there's a great truth here, a great, great truth. You notice as you go through these verses, it says this. Verse 8, Israel is swallowed up, now shall they be among the nations like a vessel in which there is no pleasure. Now what's a vessel in which there is no pleasure? Well, let's suppose you're a potter. Have you ever seen a potter work? It's interesting to watch a potter work. They'll work along and they'll get this figure, this pot begins to form, and then something will happen. They won't like it and squat, just as on again, and they break it and go bad all over again. Or, I hate to be that clay pot in which there's no pleasure, just squat, go down again. Or, if they form it and then they bake it, and in the baking process, there's a little crack, a fissure, or some disfiguration, what will they do? They'll crack, they'll break it into pieces. Now he says, Israel, now listen carefully, Israel among the nations has become like a potter's vessel in which there's no pleasure. Why, even the pagan nation look with disrespect and utter contempt on Israel. Do you see the lesson? Need I make the application? When sin begins to work, you allow that sin come to its ultimate conclusion, and it will bring you into contempt even in the eyes of the world. What does the world think of a thief, or a murderer, a drunk, a liar, prevaricator? The world doesn't think much of this. And whenever you let sin go to its ultimate conclusion, it will always bring you to disrespect in the eyes of the world. And I don't care who it is. I don't care how respectful, what a great name you have. You allow sin in your life to come to its ultimate conclusion. And it's not just the church that will look down on you. The world will look down on you. And so here, all the nations of the world, as they ringed about this nation of Israel, look with contempt on them as a potter's vessel in which there is no place. Let's move on, if we may, to the fifth reason why God was judging this nation. Verses 11 through 14. The fifth reason is given as sinful altars. Look at verse 11. Because Ephraim hath made many altars to sin, altars shall be unto him to sin. You'll notice there are many altars. Now keep your finger here and turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 5 and 6. Deuteronomy 12. The second giving of the law. Deuteronomy chapter 12. That's what Deuteronomy means, by the way, the second law. The second giving of the law. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 5 and 6. Again, Moses is preparing the people for the time when they will be in the land of Palestine. Verse 5. But under the place which the Lord your God shall choose out of all your tribes to put his name there, even unto his habitation shall ye seek, and there shalt thou come. And there you shall bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices and your tithes and heave offerings of your hands and your vows and your freewill offerings and the firstlings of your herds and of your flock. Now verse 13. Take heed to thyself that thou offer not thy burnt offerings in every place that thou seest, but in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of thy tribes, there thou shalt offer thy burnt offerings, and there thou shalt do all that I command thee. One specific spot. And what was that spot? Jerusalem, in the temple. And here they were setting up altars all over the northern kingdom, in every high place, at every sacred place, they were establishing altars. And therefore God says, I'm going to judge you, because you set up your own individual altars. Now you notice a strange expression in verse 13. They sacrifice flesh for the sacrifices of mine offerings and eat it, but the Lord accepts them not. Now will he remember their iniquity. Isn't that strange? Now he will remember their iniquity. That's not how we usually think of God. We always say, as far as the east is from the west, so far hath he removed our transgressions from us. And their sins and their iniquities will he remember no more. But that's not true here. Because of their false worship, they're going through all the ritual, but because of it, God says, I'm still going to remember your sins. It doesn't mean a thing to me. I'm keeping a record of all your sins. Verse 13. Verse 14, you'll notice that Judah is brought in. Verse 14, for Israel hath forgotten his maker and buildeth temples, and Judah hath multiplied fortified cities. Judah, the kingdom to the south, is also guilty. But you'll mark out that it says Israel has forgotten his maker and builds temples. Did you notice that? That doesn't make sense. He's forgotten his maker and he's building temples. I wonder how many churches there are in the United States today, and I wonder what the accrued value of their property is. I would gainsay that the accrued value of all the churches in the United States today would mount up into the billions of dollars. Billions of dollars. How many church plants in Richmond, Virginia are there that are worth a half a million? There are many right here in Richmond, Virginia, that are worth a half a million dollars. You take all the cities of the United States and begin to multiply them, and you begin to see that the accrued value of all the churches in the United States would amount to the billions of dollars. I don't mean investments outside of the church plant. I mean just the church plant. And yet, how many have forgotten Jesus Christ? Busy about building their plants and their buildings, lovely edifices, but they don't know Jesus Christ. Israel has forgotten their God. But despite this, they were still building their temples, just like the United States today. But the second aspect of the study tonight is the explanation of the judgment. First of all, the reasons for it, and now the explanation. What is the judgment going to consist of? Well, first of all, the death of joy. I call this the death of joy in verses 1 and 2. Rejoice not, O Israel, for joy, like other people. You hear that? Don't rejoice like other people. Other nations are permitted to rejoice. The Assyrians can rejoice, the Syrians can rejoice, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, all of these can rejoice, but not you, Israel. I don't want you to rejoice. And that teaches me a very pungent lesson. It is possible for an unsaved person to be rejoicing and happy where a Christian cannot be. And the unsaved person may be honestly happy. He may be rejoicing just as openly and honestly as can be. And a Christian cannot at the same time rejoice because he's got some sin in his heart. Let me turn that around. Some of the most miserable, cantankerous, and mean people I've run across in my life are Christians out of fellowship. That's true. They're just downright miserable because they've got a conflict in their heart that nobody else knows about. But an unsaved person can have his whoopee, he can have his joy, and they'll never have any conflict because that's their life. But a Christian will have conflict. And because Israel was God's chosen people, he said, these other people can rejoice, but I don't want you to rejoice because you're my people and you're not living as you ought to be. All right, let's look at it now. Rejoice not, O Israel, for joy like other people, for thou hast played the harlot from thy God, thou hast loved the reward upon every threshing floor. Now, what are you saying is this. You loved the reward upon every threshing floor in the sense that you worship a false god. And because you worship that false god, you think that you have abundant crops. And the reward of your worshiping of that false god is the wheat on the threshing floor. So the reward of your worshiping of these false gods is this wheat. And that's what he's saying. You love the reward upon every threshing floor. The floor and the winepress shall not feed them. Israel is not going to get this crop. The new wine shall fail in her because another nation is going to come and sweep away all of the abundant harvest. So the first explanation is the death of joy. The second explanation is the exile from their land, verses 3 through 6. Verse 3, they, that is Israel, shall not dwell in the Lord's land, but Ephraim shall return to Egypt, and they shall eat unclean things in Assyria. Now, these are two diverse directions. Egypt is way down to the southwest. Israel, it said, is going to eat or be going down into Egypt, way down over here, and they shall eat unclean things in Assyria. In 722 or 721, it's debated, in 722 B.C., Assyria came down. When Assyria came down, many of the people of Israel fled down into Egypt and lived there. And the rest that were left were carried captive away into Assyria. So it is said that they would go down into Egypt and they would eat unclean things in Assyria. And this is true. It was both nations that were involved. And they could eat unclean things in Assyria because they wouldn't have a chance to eat pure food. They'd be so hungry that if they had pork offered to them, they'd eat the pork. That was the only thing they'd have. They wouldn't have a chance for lamb or beef. They'd have to eat unclean food. Furthermore, they could not worship any longer. Look at verse 4. They shall not offer wine offerings to the Lord, neither shall they be pleasing unto him, and so on. Verse 5. What will you do in this solemn day and in the day of the feast of the Lord? They wouldn't be able to offer. They would be in a foreign land all by themselves. They wouldn't have a chance to worship. So the second explanation is exile. The third explanation of what was going to be involved in the judgment is the law of spiritual discernment. Verse 7. The days of judgment are come. The days of recompense are come. Israel shall know it. The prophet is a fool. The spiritual man is mad. Why? Well, because of the multitude of thine iniquity and the great hatred. In other words, this is what the Israelites were saying of God's prophet. You're crazy, man. I can't dig that stuff. I can't believe that. They would look on the prophet and the holy man as being mad or a fool. And they would say in verse 8, the prophet is a snare to the fowler in all his ways. He just did a way to trip him up so that they would not believe what he is saying. Now verse 9. They have deeply corrupted themselves as in the days of Gibeah. I don't suppose there is a more dastardly sin in the whole of the Old Testament than the sin that occurred at Gibeah. In Judges chapter 19, we won't even read it, but you may remember there's a Levite who had his concubine and he was making a trip back home. And the only place where he could find to stay was in the city of Gibeah. And he was going to sleep in the street. And a man came along and said, "You stay in my house tonight." And after they had gone into the house, the men of the city said, "We want that man. We want to know him. Who is that man?" And the host said, No, I've got a daughter. You used her." And finally, the Levite said, "No, you can use my concubine." And he put the concubine out in the street with those men. And those men so abused her all night, they killed her. And then the Levite took that woman and cut her body up into 12 pieces and set the 12 pieces of the body to the 12 tribes of Israel. You remember that incident? A horrible incident. And of course, the whole nation of Israel rose as one against the tribe of Benjamin and Gibeah the city. And they slaughtered the men of Benjamin until there were only 600 of the men left. It's a terrible incident. You're saying, the nauseating stench of that sin at Gibeah is coming into my nostrils once again with yours. Putrefying, vile people. And this is what he is saying. They have deeply corrupted themselves as in the day of Gibeah. Horrible thing. The loss of spiritual discernment was the third thing. It's amazing. When men throw off the word of God, they will go into the depths of degradation because they have no guidance and no direction and no discernment. The fourth aspect of judgment is a declining birth rate, verses 10 to 16. Today we're involved in the problem of population control, but in this day it was for the benefit of the people to have many people. I'm still not convinced this is right. Look at China. They're getting to be one of the strongest nations of the world just because of their population. And this is the way they looked upon population in Israel's day. The more you could have as children, the greater would be your nation. And so it was one of the curses of the judgment was a declining birth rate. Now it begins this way in verse 10. I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. Now he's talking about Israel when it was first new, when it was a young nation, why it was just as fresh and sweet and gracious as grapes. And of all places in the wilderness, and this is where you would really appreciate grapes. I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your fathers as the first ripe in the fig tree at a first time. The very first fruits, those delicious first fruits. That's how Israel was. But that's not the way it's going to be now. Verse 11, as for Ephraim, that's another name for the northern kingdom, their glory shall fly away like a bird from the birth and from the womb and from the conception. It's going to cut down their birth rate. Though they bring up their children, yet will I bruise them. He's talking about how they are going to have a declining population. Verse 16, Ephraim is smitten, their root is dried up, they shall bear no fruit, yea, though they bring forth, yet will I slay even the beloved fruit of their womb. A declining population. Curse after curse. But the final and the ultimate curse is reserved for the last. And it's given in one verse. Verse 17. My God will cast them away because they did not hearken unto him, and they shall be wanderers among the nations. And this prophecy has been bitterly true. They have literally been wanderers among the nations. Poland, Germany, Spain, United States, Russia, Africa. You name the nation in which they're not Jews. They have become veritable wanderers among the nations. And this is due to God's judgment. Now we come thirdly to the execution of the judgment. And the execution of the judgment is in two steps. First of all, there is the retribution of Israel's sins in verses 1 to 11, and I shall not dwell long on this, but notice in verses 1 to 11, the retribution of Israel's sins, beginning with the vine figure in verse 1. Israel is an empty vine. That ought to be, Israel is a luxuriant vine, a verdant, a luxurious vine. It would be a better translation. Israel is a luxurious vine. He brings forth fruit unto himself according to the multitude of his fruit and so on. He is prosperous. He's not saying he's not prosperous, but he's prosperous. But despite the fact that he's prosperous, he does not worship God. He worships the false gods. Notice at the end of verse 1, they have made handsome images. The prosperity has caused them to go into false worship. Now the term vine is very interesting. You'll notice that often in the Old Testament, Israel is referred to as a vine. This becomes important in the New Testament. In Psalm chapter 80, Israel is a vine. Isaiah chapter 5, Israel is a vine. Jeremiah chapter 2, Ezekiel chapter 17, in all these passages, Israel is a vine. The Lord says in John 15, I am the true vine. And any Jew would immediately think of these Old Testament passages which say that Israel is a vine. So what Christ is saying is, I'm the true Israel. I'm the true chosen one of God. That's why he that abides in me. This is where there's going to be fruit. Not in just a historical group of people like Israel. I'm the true vine. Israel is looked upon as the vine in the Old Testament, that's true, but now I'm the true vine, and you must abide in me. It's just not a matter of being physically born into Israel, and that's what he's saying in John chapter 15. But back here in Hosea, Israel again is a vine, but this time a luxurious vine is bringing forth fruit unto idolatry. Well, let's move on. We'll notice that in verse 4, we have broken covenants. They have spoken words, swearing falsely and making a covenant. That is, they made covenants with Egypt, they made covenants with Assyria, and they broke them. Verse 8, the high places also of Avon, the sin of Israel shall be destroyed. The thorn and the thistle shall come up on their altars, and they shall say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. Have you seen that before? Where have you seen that? what book in the New Testament? Revelation chapter 6, verse 16. Revelation chapter 6 is anticipating the tribulation. You have the same thing in Luke chapter 23, by the way. And it's anticipating the tribulation, what's going to happen in the tribulation. But what happened in Israel back then was just a figure. The sufferings of Assyria coming in, just a figure of what the tribulation will be on this earth in the future. Now we go into verse 11. And Ephraim is like an heifer that is taught and loves to tread out the grain. But he passed over upon her fair neck. I will make Ephraim to ride, Judah shall plow, and Jacob shall break his cry. Now that's interesting to any farmer. Any person that comes from the country, that's an interesting one. Even from Hinckley, Minnesota. We didn't even thresh like this side in Hinckley, though. This is talking about the way they used to thresh. Now, if you were a cow, you would love to work on a threshing floor. It was easy. All you had to do was walk, and you could eat any time you wanted to. It was against the law to muzzle the treading ox. Now, he says that Ephraim is like an heifer that is taught to walk on this threshing floor. And it loves this job. But now God says, I'm going to take you off the threshing floor. And I'm going to put something on your neck. I'll pass over, that is, I'll pass a harness over your neck. And I'll make you plow. And you're going to have to be working hard work. And you won't be able to bend down and eat whenever you want to. I am going to put you into a harness so that you're really going to have to work hard. And this is an illustration of what's going to be involved in their persecution in the future. The execution of the judgment, first of all, refers to their retribution of their sins in verses 1 to 11. Now in verses 12 to 15, we have an allusion to Assyria. And he says in verse 14, therefore shall a tumult arise among thy people, and all thy fortresses shall be spoiled, as Shalman, and many people say Shalman either. Shalman spoiled Beth Arbo in a day of battle, and here is the judgment. The mother was dashed in pieces upon her children. The Assyrians were known for their violence, for their inhumane treatment of their captives. And here's an illustration of it. The mothers were beat down on their children so that both the mother and the children were killed in one fell swoop, as well as the warriors. And this is what he is saying is coming. Israel is coming. Assyria is coming in its judgment. And that's why we have verse 12. Sow to yourselves in righteousness, reap in mercy. Sow righteousness, reap mercy. Break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord, till he come and rain righteousness upon you. You have plowed wickedness. You have reaped iniquity. You have eaten the fruit of lies. What's he saying? What you sow, you'll reap. If you sow righteousness, you'll reap mercy. If you sow wickedness, you'll reap iniquity and violence. And that's what he is saying. And this is why the Assyrians are coming. So here in chapters 8, 9, and 10, we have the judgment of Israel. Now, just a minute. Who was Israel? May I change that? Who is Israel? Why, Israel is God's chosen people. God chose Israel specifically for himself. And yet he is judging them for their sins. When I read chapters 8, 9, and 10, and I recognize that God is doing this with his chosen people, I begin to see how sinful sin really is. You know why we sin so often? Well, there are many reasons. We have a sin nature, for one. But one of the reasons we sin as often as we do is because we do not realize the sinfulness of sin. And as I read chapters 8, 9, and 10, and I see what God did with Israel, God's chosen people, to take them and dash the women against the children, to smite them and to kill them, to murder them, to carry the remainder away captive into a strange land, I begin to see how God despises sin. Sin never dies of itself. Either we judge it or God will judge it.